Welcome to Talking Anthropology. Today's show is about the Indian hacker scene, and I'm proud to introduce my interview partner for today, Kaes Abirachi, who is a security researcher, a hacker, and a blogger about security and hacker topics. Hello, Abirachi.
Hello, Thomas.
Would you like to introduce yourself or add something?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I am Kaes Abirachi, a security research analyst, as well as one of the chief security researchers of White Hat People, a specialized subcategorized group of White Hat Guru community. And our team consists of specialized consultants from various niche of industries nationally and sharing a common vision. Our team also includes specialists in exploit writing, Cisco security products, compliance, wireless security, and pen testing. And also, I'm one of the members of Cloud Audit Standard Workspace, which exists to coordinate the efforts of cloud audit with standards. And our deliverable focus on enhancing and expanding the compliance packs. And also, I'm co-leading Security B-Sites India chapter.
And White Hat Group is an Indian nationwide organization, for those who don't know it. And also, there's quite a bunch of hackerspaces in India, which can be found over the Hackerspaces Wiki. But I think you are the biggest one, or?
Yeah, you can call us one of the biggest one, because we have around four biggest communities over India. The leading ones are Club Hack, Nelcon, White Hat Guru, and Security B-Sites.
When did this whole hacker thing started in India?
Actually, you can't just call it like, you know, it had been from earlier times, from 1990s, actually, when Indian hacking scene was totally dependent on rivalry among hackers and hackers. And presently, you can categorize it into many things. Like now you can categorize it into rivalry among Indian hackers as well as Pakistani hackers. Then government versus government utilizing hacker streams for government objectives. It's a scene like that. Okay, then let me start with the Indian hacking scene and all the local hackers group over here. Mm-hmm. Actually, normally it started during Independence Day. When it kind of, this time also, the Independence Day was to a nightmare for some of the webmasters as well as web owners of both India as well as its neighboring countries. There have been cyber attacks on websites of both India and Pakistan and China everywhere. A lot of portals were hacked and defaced. Yet, this time the specialty was the attack was initiated by Pakistani hackers defacing some Indian hacking websites, hacked websites actually, which was already hacked by Chinese groups. They attacked that on 14th August. That's their Independence Day. That's Pakistan's Independence Day. Yet, this was followed up by counterattacks from Indian hacker stream. And the hackers were normally started by two Pakistani groups called Pak Cyber Army and Pak Hackers. And I believe they defaced around 20 to 30 websites at every Independence Day. And Indian hackers counter-attacked and led the initial and the Indian Cyber Army, who were, from the Indian perspective, hacker groups, who had defaced around more than 1,226 Pakistani sites. So it's that kind of thing. Yeah, so it was that. So now you can see the proportion of defaced sites by Indian comparatively. It clearly shows us that nationalism was automatically aroused when Indian portals get tickled by other national hackers.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of thing.
And are these independent hacker groups, or are they really publicly driven or in a closed connection to the government?
It's a total different synonymous over here, because when we speak, because there are more groups over here like HMG, that's Hindu Militant Guard or Hindu Militant Group. They were the ones who used to be very active in awkward communities. They used to hack various Pak communities, and after taking on the ownership of those communities, they turned them into anti-Pakistan ones. And so these kinds of hacks were pretty common during 2006, 2007, and 2008. And these kinds of groups actually defended its hacking practices by calling it a revenge against Pakistani hackers who were involved in tracking Indian websites and awkward communities. It was more likely that both hacker nationalists were aggravated by each other's atrocities. So the end was never seen here.
So you have this national conflict between India and Pakistan, which also plays a role on the hacker level with counter attacks, and one is always trying to deface the sides of the other. And how long is this going on since the '90s? You said,
I think from 2005.
For 2005.
Still present. Yeah, and I don't think that whether it would get stopped or something, it would continue till the end.
Okay.
Yeah,
is
that like that?
There's probably also a lot of damage in an economical sense, which is done by these defacings.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one of the things. And moreover, when we take this to government side, when for seeing like government versus government utilizing hacker streams for government objections, in April 2010, a cyber group called the Shadow Network, based in China, penetrated Indian government systems, definitely sniffing some sensitive documents. Yet, as according to sources, they didn't got much to taste. Yet, what did these spies did was, I had also presented a small talk on my research work, which was basically on Shadow Network. In that, I also specified the spies did that they configured their control servers to work with free internet services, including Twitter, Google Groups, Baidu Blocks, and Yahoo Mail. The free services allowed the attackers to maintain control of compromised computers, even if they lost contact with the command or control servers. In the technical notion, we can say that emails were sent to target organizations that contain contextually relevant information. This email contained malicious attachments that, when opened, drop a Trojan host onto the system. Mm-hmm. This Trojan connects back to the control server, usually located on the hubs, controlled by the attacker. And these infected systems then executes the command specified by the control server. And occasionally, if notified, it's seen that command specified by control servers cause the infected computers to install another Trojan application that allowed attacker to gain complete real-time control of computers. Such a computer can now be controlled on and inspected by attackers, and even has the ability to turn on camera and audio recording function of infected computers, even enable them to monitor and do kind of surveillance. So many investigations conducted by Department of Defense and other research groups claimed that cyber espionage is carried out from servers located in China that compromised government, business, academic, and other network systems in India.
Mm-hmm.
And also, in India, this technology was monitored by NTRO, that's National Technological Research Group, and DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, were in charge of cyber offensive capabilities. Moreover, with mounting instances of cyber attacks and espionage, several governments have already formulated an infrastructure to combat this menace.
Hmm. So we are speaking about large-scale targeted attacks, really, on a nationwide level. And
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, okay. That's very different to the types of attacks that at least are known here in Europe or in the States, I think. But it's also a different situation in Asia. And do you have any guess on the specific targets or the amount of machines that are controlled?
Moreover, I think it takes a lot of time in planning all these things. And I do think that not a hacker group can do all this stuff. Definitely a government utilizing hacker streams can do and publish all these government objectives. So you can see in a way that cyber warfare is arising. And moreover, it has arisen, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had Stuxnet in the European media, which drove attention again to this issue of cyber war. And
exactly,
it's since 5 years reality in India and China and Pakistan. But
yeah,
okay.
What I actually feel about this cyber warfare is it has already been initiated with complete unique mission objectives, including espionage and data theft. Theft of trade secrets and critical technologies, which automatically implies to a kind of economic espionage. And moreover, the modus operandi of having cyber evangelists in each government for a kind of guiding their networks to a safe place can soon be seen offensive in nature. That is, for spying the classified data of hostile nations by getting into their systems.
The possibilities are critical. I mean, control over industrial facilities. We're speaking about nations who have all atomic weapons or very critical infrastructure in their hands. And how do you understand yourself? How do you positionate yourself in this war? Are you definitely on the Indian side, there to protect your country as a kind of independent cyber army? Or are you more in the public and trying to inform what's going on?
Normally, our team is with Indian side and normally give hands to Indian industries and Indian government for accomplishing things to prevent and to mitigate the risk against these kinds of threats.
Okay, so it's also a kind of counseling job you do, and the classical security industry, you are trying to make the system safe. You're trying to prevent attacks.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. We have quite a huge technology industry in India. This is a non-fact. I think that India started at a very rudimentary level of IT security, of IT technology. But right now, you're also a technology center with a lot of innovation. And what are the numbers? How many hackers, how many people who are active in this game in India would you think are?
Actually, it's countless. Actually, it's countless. No one can count the number of groups over India who is working along with the government and who is working independently. But at the same time, every state has different kind of hacker communities who try to do their best and who tries to rise nationalism whenever a kind of threat arises from different nations. And I do believe, I never think India lacks infrastructure to fight cybercrime and cyberterrorism. It's just the way they do it.
And which role do hackerspaces play in India? Are they just some place to meet for those people who are into the issue, or is it more this maker scene connected thing?
Actually, normal in hacker groups of India, they are totally open to everyone. They have regular local meetups over place, and they have a national meetup in place where different communities like Department of Defense of India, DIA and NTRO guys to come over to see on how things are going about here and what new things can this hacker space can give to the government. And
wow.
So it's a kind of collaboration thing. It's totally open to everyone and anyone who wants to get into the space. It's like that over here.
So there's a close connection between government and Indian hacker groups.
You can't just call them like that, but it's like whenever a kind of awareness thing is availed over from India, we do call those guys so that they can see the threat capabilities that what, because there is a direct connection proportional ratio between the private industry and the public industry. So for that, we do organize different kind of community meets over here where we do call them so that they can have a glitch over things on which industry is going side by side.
Okay. And how is the connection in the Indian hacker scene with the international scene? How I've seen that you have been at Black Hat Conference in Las Vegas. Do you feel connected with the rest, with the European or the American hacker scene, or are there differences?
Yeah, we do get connected with every kind of guys except from China and Pakistan. I don't think that our intelligence with them goes in a better hand because it always gets in a kind of rivalry thing between us. Except them, all the Russian hackers, the American hackers, and we do get along with them in a very good manner.
And what are the biggest Indian conferences you could name?
They have Club Hack conference, and presently Club Hack was inviting Mr. Bruce Nair, the CTO of BT and the CyberSec Guru. He would be coming to Pune this time to speak over a glimpse of how hacking has emerged and the things, stuff like that. So we have Club Hack, we have Nullcon, we have Security B-Sites, and we have local community meet of a White Hat Guru and White Hat people.
Is there something existing like maker-oriented hacker scene. I mean, it looks like for me that there is a kind of difference, because in Europe the term hacker became really wide. We started to include a lot of stuff, a lot of blinking lights, opened the concept up for everyone who is just creative and who tries to just use things in a different manner as they were intended to. And in India, I have the feeling it's much more down to the ground of what it really used to mean, and that you have to really create something protect something to be a hacker.
Yeah, exactly. Because in here, everyone wants to help the government as well as the industry to maximize the value of information security and information technology. So every community holds seminars and conferences for government as well as industry professionals to have a glitch over the present complex security conceptualities. And they do make them understand and update on present technologies with security perspective mainly. And improving support operations or processes based on community feedback and action is always there. Track and evaluation of support operations using measurable benchmarks and quality assurance techniques do exist everywhere in India.
What are the standards of the public IT infrastructure in India?
Despite the global economic slowdown, India continues to become one of the world's fastest growing information communication and technology markets between August 2006 and July 2010. And moreover, in March 2010, India reached a new high, adding over approximately 20 million new mobile phone subscribers in that month sole. While India has undertaken a number of policy initiatives to open up the market area of concern, still remains that to freedom of use of strong encryption. There was always a concern about the strong encryption thing in India. In addition to the telecommunications license amendments concerns, India has failed to adopt policies that protect the freedom to use security encryption online, which has placed many companies in a precarious operating situations in the country. And normally, as seen, strong encryption is a global norm for securing information online, yet it be such as confidential business information, financial information, internal government communications from intrusion from hackers, competitors, and other wrongdoers. In order to create a strong and workable encryption policies, India is following other developed nations in creating public-private partnerships to discuss encryption and broader InfoSec issues. Since InfoSec has a significant effect on privacy, the government process is actually in the judicial system that allows law enforcement access to network information, but at the same time respects the legal rights of an individual. Mm-hmm. So as you might have known, the BlackBerry case, in which there was a huge calamity kind of thing over in India as well as UAE also. So same like that. That's all.
Mm-hmm. So
speaking of on the digital world, the digital world is leading to a resurgence of, you know, kind of democratic organization that is only beginning to be understood. Social networking, emails, and cheap long-distance telephony make it possible to contact large number of people quickly and cheaply. Undoubtedly, terrorists are also using these networks. But to counter them, one needs careful intelligence at the ground level rather than a heavy bulge that tramples on our rights as well.
Good. I'm trying to sum this up. Of course, India's industry is growing. And I mean, do you think that security and things like end-to-end encryption are really things the government should take care of? Or aren't they something which are in the hands of those who invent the products, those who use the net with their services? Of course, we're counseling from whoever is able to give them the knowledge to make it secure. But where's the role of the state in this sense? I mean, is the Indian state really something which is in structuring the infrastructure?
Yes, sure.
Does he make decisions?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, when you talk about security over in IT government thing, then definitely there are very big things, because the Indian government has well documented and named cyber intrusions it has experienced and continues to fight on a daily basis. it's widely believed that the foreign governments are behind some of these invasions, as they have that documented in a very well manner. These cyber intrusions are not bringing down the network, actually, not destroying the power grid, nor disturbing the banking system, nor bringing down the airplanes or destroying common governmental functions. Instead, what they are doing is they are reconnaissance, a kind of reconnaissance is going on over here, collecting data and exfiltrating the data through a series of network relays. This, as said earlier, is actually espionage of which Indian government has been aware of. Corporate India is now coming to grips with the same threat as against its intellectual property. Now it's a kind of business of foreign intelligence agencies to collect information on India government plans, intelligence technology. So when we are speaking about this thing, I do believe that traditional cybersecurity defenders have to deal with, and I believe that they are getting better, not only with government, but cross-sector and cross-agency coordination.
We're speaking a lot about this this two or three nation issue, that India has to protect its IT infrastructure, and that there is obviously a war going on in this layer.
Sure.
And do you think this is a known issue in the public? Do you think the people are aware that is the word cyber attack in the media?
Yeah, they are aware of those things. They are surely aware of those things, because these things get highlighted very fast over in India.
In whole of India? I mean, India.
Yeah, in whole of India, because it directly affects the economic as well as financial issues in India. So definitely, this the guys over the who are working with economic spectrum, the financial spectrum of the industry, gets to know about these things, and this directly gets reached to the general public.
Well, let's speak about the issue of another aspect of security and transparency. How transparent is the Indian state? How does it look with civil rights in the internet in India?
I believe it's a presently after we in India, the actual law has been passed till on 2000, and now many different kinds of amendments have been increased from 2008. So moreover, I do think that every country has the right to spy on any form of communication to protect their citizens from terrorists and related activities. So this is done over here in the name of security, and I don't have any problem with any government if my emails and telephones are scanned. I don't care, as long as I am safe and my privacy is not exploited.
Mm-hmm. So you trust the government?
Yeah, so we trust the government, that's true.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Here we generally don't, but how much surveillance do you have? Do you have something like deep packet inspection? Do you have backdoors in the general public email services? Or how is the structure which the normal citizen uses, not the companies?
Actually, see, when seen from the government side, they do their regular kind of surveillance by putting different kinds of sensors in the government places, as well as in the ISPs of the different telecom companies. They do have that. That was the main problem over the BlackBerry case over in Hindi also, because the government needed to monitor BlackBerry corporate data that they should ask corporations themselves for access, since they are the one who holds the key. But what India did was they made BlackBerry create local BlackBerry servers in our country so that they can directly access, or they can do a kind of surveillance through that server. So see a kind of that perspective, where India puts their own sensors in different ISPs to look things around.
Mm-hmm. And there is no issue in the hacker scene that maybe it is wrong for the state to go that far into the personal data of someone else just to proclaim general security and against the terror threat.
See, what I would call is it's a better thing, as it's better than getting knocked out by terrorists. It's a better thing than knocked out by terrorists. Let's see.
Okay, so, and how many terroristical attacks have been in India in the last 10 years?
In the last 2 years, there have been many attacks, but the cyber initiative, but the cyber kind of thing, where they included cyber kind of economical things over in cyber thing, is way less, because they don't use much of cyber they don't use much kind of cyber espionage over to normal public things. They do use public transports, they do use public services to get in hand to plan things out, but they never they don't use a cyber thing in detail.
Yeah, but speaking about, I don't know, was there a power plant shut off or some real huge lack of information that really showed we have an intrusion here and something has gone wrong? Any major things that happened in the last time?
Yeah, as I told you earlier, in April 2010, in present year only, we had a cyber group called Shadow Networks, based in China particularly. Mm. They had penetrated Indian government systems, definitely sniffing some sensitive documents. Yet, as according to sources, they didn't got much of the taste.
Yeah.
That was the sole one of the biggest thing which happened nearby.
Okay. Yeah, it is a huge thing. I'm just trying to get a picture of what the general situation is, except of this huge case you described before.
Yeah.
And some day-to-day stuff. I mean, how is it? I'm just trying to make it understandable for listeners how we can imagine a situation in India where you have a middle class firm and you have your average IT infrastructure in your facilities, and is there a real threat? Is there a real a chance to get attacked just by sitting in the Indian network and be known as a firm?
Surely. It's when we are speaking of security over Indian government IT as well as Indian firms, that's actually a very hard question to answer, because as the government, they have, and as well as the industries, they have done a lot to improve the security postures of our assets. But in doing so, the adversary has also gotten more technically confident and stronger. Yet we are more secure than we were yesterday. Yet it doesn't end here. It got to continue to grow up and to keep up with the adversary. The adversary may be able to focus on certain technologies against certain assets. Yet what we are doing over here is we have got to be able to look across the whole spectrum of assets and be able to defend that and keep up with the change in technology and abilities of the adversary. Now this seems quite a challenge, because to achieve that, we do have to work in a reactive environment to be able to look at different alerts that government gets through various monitoring programs, to get reports from departments, agencies, that really helps to paint a picture of it. But because this isn't a one organization problem, they do rely heavily on with the coordination with industries to understand the environment. So we can try to stay ahead of the challenges. The sensors, as I told earlier, are just on the government. That's a small percentage of the national assets with respect to critical infrastructure and with industry, etc. So we do have to rely on other information resources, like as said earlier, industry, law, enforcement, etc., to be able to paint that picture and understand that environment to be proactive, instead of relying on the retrospective analysis and the reactive measures that traditionally cyber security defenders have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I do strongly believe that we are getting better, not only with the government, but as I told earlier, with respect to cross-sector and cross-agency coordination.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about all this infrastructure that's deployed, is the equipment partially also used for censorship, for blacklisting of certain sites, or sniffing into traffic? I mean, I know you have this whole big threat of national attacks from China or from Pakistan, but there are also some other concerns about just normal private people who are using the same net, who go through the same filters. Is there...
We do have our different kinds of sensors established and standardized by Indian government in different ISPs on by different telecom sectors. We do have that.
So net neutrality, is this a discussion in India, or it's not a goal you have?
It's not. Actually, we don't see over it, because we just trust our ISPs for all these things. Blindly.
And you never had any bad experiences?
No, we never had any kind of bad experience over here.
And no critical blog went offline just because you had the wrong information, which someone else didn't like? That's not happening?
No, it's not happening as much because these sensors, as I told you earlier, these sensors have been established very carefully, and all the hacker teams as well as different security evangelists are working together to get a glitch of things on how to secure these aspects, these basic aspects of to provide privacy and different kinds of issues to the general guys.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one issue is to make things secure, but the other is also to have a system which is generally still free enough to use, and the internet was once made as a system where which is not censored, but right now it is technically possible, and of course it's done. But the sensor infrastructure in India is, do you have an open blacklist? Is it public? Which sites are blocked? Or
I don't think that it's a public thing because it's always dealt with the NTRO and the ISP owners. We don't have, no public has a even kind of knowledge about all this stuff on how the sensors are categorized and how the sensors are made to work, or how these sensors do sense different kinds of threats and vulnerabilities.
Okay. The issue of electronic voting machines has been a big one in India, as far as I know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let me confirm you that.
Give us the story. What happened?
Yeah, exactly. In 2009, actually, the Election Commission of India publicly challenged on an argument of discussion to a computer scientist and asked a security and challenged a security researcher called Hari Prasad to show his that actually India's voting machine can be compromised, but refused to give him access to that machines to perform a review. So earlier this year, what happened was an anonymous source provided an Indian voting machine to a research team led by Prasad, Alex Halderman, and one called Rob Gongrip. And so they published a paper detailing their findings. They actually exposed several security flaws that could allow an attacker to change election results and compromise ballot secrecy. So this was the main issue over the electronic voting machine in India.
Mm-hmm. Which the first thing which is strange is that they asked him to find out if the system is secure, and then they would not even allow him to get close to a machine.
Exactly, because it was mainly based on a discussion, actually. It initiated with a discussion, yet resulted with a security breach in the electronic voting machine.
Mm-hmm. And one fact you missed out is that Hari Prasad, who had this contract from the government to look at the voting machine, was also arrested after...
He was arrested, but within a week he was given freedom and he was bailed out. And he was it was a very big thing over in India, yet our government apologized with him and did meant a thing like they helped him to accomplish the vulnerabilities and to give the solutions to these vulnerabilities. And so he also, and he's presently in a group of guys, they are completing this project to have a total secure electric voting machine in India.
And you believe that electronic voting machines could work and could be secure?
Because Hari Prasad is working towards the benefitment of the electronic voting machine. Now, all the breaches which he had shown to us, he and his team is the one who are actually fixing that problems also for us. So I believe within some time it would go fine.
So you really, generally speaking, believe that electronic voting is something that could work, that could be secure?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, because here again, I mean, how can you trust a machine in such a sensitive issue, especially when it's closed source? I mean, you have...
As I told you earlier, none of the Indian hacking communities works to deface on Indian systems. They don't try to expand their spectrum to cause a problem to Indians. They never try to do that. It's the first, it's totally based on trust thing.
Yeah, but it's this thing with trust. You never can trust 100%. And when you have no possibility to recall the result of an election, then this is a big issue in a democracy, and you will never get a system which you can completely trust, also because every democratic election, the citizens should be able, at least in theory, to understand how it works, and with a electronic voting system, especially a closed source voting system, this is impossible by theory.
Yeah, but very true. Therefore, the Supreme Court of India has ordered Hari Prasad to work on to complete all the breaches which were made vulnerable by him, or which he had shown exploitable. Now he and his team is working to fill those gaps.
Yeah, but do you think that all these gaps he found are there are no more? I mean, every machine has security holes, and what are the plans? Let's speak about this. Do they really want to use these electronic voting machines nationwide for every election?
Yeah, they want to use this thing, and they are reconsidering the design of this thing. They are totally remaking it once again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like condition like that.
On which operating system is it based?
I don't think it's a. I think it's a Windows embedded thing.
Okay. And what's the time plan? Till when?
Moreover, by coming 6 months.
Coming 6 months, then they are deployed.
Yeah, then they are deployed.
God help. Okay. This would be just impossible because I don't want to make. I don't want to value all these things from the outside. From my perspective, it's crazy because the electronic voting machines have been proven to be often a very bad project, because why do you want to have electronic voting in the first place? What's the benefit of it?
First thing is we don't trust much of physical security over here. Physical security gets turned up by different good politicians. They use their source to physically tamper all this stuff. So basically what this was an idea was that we can easily have different kinds of machines to conquer around 1,000 of votes in a go, rather than take it personally from a place to another in a paper thing. So the physical security always lagged in that process. So therefore, it was always a concern for Indian government to make it electronically as soon as possible.
After Hari Prasad was let out of prison, wasn't there also an option which was included that these electronic voting machines could also have a paper trail, a paper backup system where you could afterwards also count the votes by hand and have the normal hierarchy and check and balance system? Only as a second layer. I mean, this is a really sensitive issue, and you should really have as much security as you can. And with paper system, at least in theory, you can prove that the calculation is right.
Yeah, till it was proved that the electronic voting machine was really susceptible to all these kinds of vulnerabilities. At that point of time, for district elections, we did use handout things. And presently, also we are using our handout things for the district elections and normal panchayat elections in India. And moreover, I think after 6 to 8 months only, we'll be deploying all the electronic things again after proper testing and maintenance thing.
And are there any NGOs opposing electronic voting in India? Is there an opposition?
Definitely there would be an opposition by different guys who prefer to have handouts better. They considered it better than the electronic voting machine. But at the end, what Indian government need was they wanted it fast to be done, yet with less tampering of things. And so they preferred. In India, the environment is such that they prefer more of an electronic thing than the physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a condition like that over in India.
Yeah, India is very optimistic about information technology, also in the public sector, which is also something that has changed in the last years, or
it has totally changed. It has totally changed after the UID biometric project has arrived over India. It has totally changed the IT It has revolutionized the niche of information technology aroused in Indian government after the Aadhaar program or the Unique Identity Authority came over India.
Mm-hmm.
In which they are creating a number of around 1.4. They are giving UID cards to around 1.2 billion citizens over everyone in India. It's a very big project, and it's a huge project with an estimation cost of around $2 billion to around $4.4 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
we go one issue further. There was also a government effort for the biometrical recognition of citizens. And as far as I'm informed, it was a method which combined fingerprints and iris scan to count and have numbers on the whole citizenship in India.
Exactly. I'm speaking of this same thing actually. It's called the Aadhaar program over. It's actually called the Aadhaar program, which was earlier referred as UID project, the Unique Identification Authority UID project, that kind of project. And actually, let me give you a brief information of that thing also, as you have touched that thing. It was like the UID would be using multiple types of biometric data for identification, including, as you said, retina scans, fingerprints of all 10 fingers, and multiple facial images. The system was so complex that no single company has all the required skills to develop it. So a consortium of Accenture, Mindtree, Down from Ireland, and Neurotechnology from Lithuania designed the biometric data capture, categorization, storage, and retrieval process. And now they are, and I think by coming 1 year or 2 years, they are going to be deployed over there. They have started the initiative actually.
Mm-hmm.
So it has its own pros and cons. If you're seeing the pros of that Aadhaar program, we can do say that UID will yield significant benefits to Indians. They would just need only one ID document for their government services, banking, and more unlikely, like the present scenario of having electronic iCard votes for voter machines, ration cards, healthcare cards, driver license, and passport thing. They don't need all this stuff from now on after having this accomplished. There was always a concern that a lot of welfare benefits that government provides don't reach the intended beneficiaries because they can't correctly identify them. The UID would hopefully enable better targeting, identification of beneficiaries, and plug leakages. And moreover, the government expects to save around $4.3 billion annually with a UID program. So it's not a small thing over here.
Mm-hmm. It sounds very optimistic. So
yeah, great. Yet the challenges against this are also very huge. Beyond developing these smart cards, the challenge is making the backend infrastructure secure and scalable, ensuring privacy and integrating agents who issues the numbers. Other critics to fear that erosion of civil liberties will take place. Misused national database could allow police or intelligence groups to discriminate against people by caste, religion, or birthplace. And moreover, on technical side, the UID database will be susceptible to attacks and leaks at various levels. It's a thing beyond imagination. And suppose we are seeing the vulnerable side of biometrics. It's not a small thing. Authentication of a person normally is used basically based on only three things. Something that the person knows, such as password, or something physical the person possesses, like an actual key or token, or something about the person's appearance or behavior. So biometric authentication relies on the third approach. Its advantage is that unlike a password or a token, it can work without active input from the user. That makes it both convenient and efficient. Yet there is nothing to carry, forget, or lose. Yet that's its main disadvantage. The biometric screening can also work without users' cooperation or even knowledge. Covert identification may be a boon when screening for a terrorist or criminals, but it raises serious concerns for innocent individuals. That's a thing which you have to consider, actually. The biometric identification can even invite violence. Yeah. I had just last time heard about a motorist in Germany had a finger chopped off by thieves. Seeking to steal his exotic car, which used a fingerprint reader instead of a conventional door lock. So that is a very big problem which can arise over India. And another problem with biometrics is that the traits used for identification are not secret, but exposed for all and sundry to see. People leave fingerprints all over place. Voices are recorded, faces photographed endlessly. appearance and body language is captured on security cameras at every turn. Replacing misappropriated biometric traits is nowhere near as easy as issuing a replacement for forgotten passwords or lost key, which is the main concern over everywhere. In addition, it's not that difficult for imposters to subvert fingerprint readers or other biometric devices too. So it's a case which I think has to be implemented very carefully after having identified ways over its cons and measures to mitigate this kind of risk, this kind of basic risk.
I'm nearly speechless. Do you think this thing will come in India? Is it generally optimistic or is it generally pessimistic? I mean,
it's a thing which you can see. I would, as a security guy person, I would call it pessimistic. But yeah. Indian government has started initiative. But as Indian government has started its initiative on. They have put around $26 million to start with this program, and they have started with some villages over in India. Mm-hmm. They have initiated this process.
Breaking it down technically, I mean, you have all this biometrical information which would replace every other identification, where you have no token, as you call it, or no passport, no document that is valid in sense for your identity. In many cases, instead, you have just a huge database and sensors and an output which judges whether you are entitled to some benefit to access an area or to get your loan out of a machine. And this system will be central database, probably not encrypted or.
Exactly. The thing is that it would be encrypted. It would be highly encrypted, but it would be a central database. It would be a central database, which is being considered by many physical things. And I think by cross-referencing current systems and deduplicating database, the government expects fraud to decline tremendously, which as a security consultant, I don't believe it. Seriously speaking, there are many, many ways in which we can harm, we can take on. See, a normal kind of cross-site scripting and these kind of stuff can easily be dumped into a normal database without getting into the firewall and stuff. So when these command line parameters are always there to get into the system, then it's a very big thing to, put up this thing in a very wide space all over India.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be compromised very easily.
Yeah, and
that's
why don't do it? Is the benefit so huge that it's worthwhile the risk?
That's the government belief that the pros contains more than its cons. The pros are more than its cons. Then, and as government believes that thing, we are trying hard on our side to find out vulnerabilities on such stuff so that we can show them directly that all these are not as safe as they think it is. So there are researchers going around working on biometric systems, and they are too trying from their side to make it as secure as possible. And from our side, we are trying our best to get a kind of help thing for the government by finding out more vulnerabilities, more suspects or more trials which can be easily mitigated to a kind of risk.
But as a security analyst, do you really think mm-hmm. such a thing, which is so central and which is so valuable, could ever be really secure?
It can. Yeah, see, I said earlier, see, as security evangelists, we do see its cons more than its pros.
Mm.
And as those government who want much beneficiaries from biometric systems, they are seeing much pros from their cons. But the thing is in between, actually. You have to take care of those things, keeping in mind the biometric devices. You can use biometric devices, but I don't think it's a good idea to put it at such a wide range.
Mm. Maybe get back to the facts. This biometrical recognition, is this really for the whole population of India? I mean, do we speak of
exactly
the billion
exactly.
people you have?
Yeah, 1.2 billion citizens overall.
Okay, and that mm-hmm. would mean you also have to deploy a really lot of infrastructure to...
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
India is a very diverse country, just to point it out for listeners. You have parts which are really highly developed and technology centers, and then you have other parts which are really rural and which have nearly no infrastructure of modern times at all. And it is very diverse. You have many different ethnics, and India is not a monolithic state. So this project would also have completely different aspects and effects and reactions in various parts of the country.
Exactly, because if you see more than 60% of India citizens live in villages with spotty electricity, and they may be wary of smart card readers, say critics. And given India's 30% literacy rates, many people will be unable to read prompts in a way. In addition, an environment that includes dust, large temperature swings, and monsoons requires rugged and highly reliable equipment, which are solely against biometric systems. They need completely pure environment, a completely pure environment.
So would it work in these environments, or would you then just default back now on fingerprints? Or
Now what they are doing is they are trying their best to cover these kinds of technologies in such a way that it would work in such kind of environment. Now they are trying their best to put such kind of algorithms to put in place, such kind of devices to make it as clear as possible.
But do you think, I mean, this is a really huge project, and you said the government will put a lot of money in it, but is the focus really also on these rural areas and on the poor people? I mean...
Yeah, exactly. They are regularly being trained on these things. They have been told that it's kind of a thing which for them, they are the main beneficiaries of these things, the rural India. So they have been trained to use these products, and they have been, I think it's a very good idea to get them things done in a very good manner. But the sole concern of mine is on the back end thing, on the security of that central database. That is the whole thing which I am presently focusing on.
Yeah, I know. It's two sides. Of course, the backend is one whole bunch of risks and problems that could go good or bad. But I also want to look at the output of this system in the real life of people. And what is the benefit you have when you are in a rural area now? Your passport is no longer valid, but instead you have this strange system you don't understand, which verifies your identity.
Yeah, exactly. That's the situation. Therefore, they are being trained into speakeasily.
But what are they trained? What is the benefit?
They don't have to carry their different kinds of things for different kinds of to prove that identify they don't for to prove that identities they don't have to carry all this stuff like a normal driving license or health cards or electronic photo ID cards. They don't have to carry that, just through them. They don't need to do any kind of work. That's the main beneficiary of things. And as I told you earlier, there was always a concern that a lot of welfare benefits that government provides doesn't reach to intended beneficiaries because they can't correctly identify them. That's the main concern.
When you speak about correctly identifying them, this also includes that you have to this biometrical unique identification of people, also information concerning their income, their social status, where they live, what they do, a very big database to be so specific. This is also part of the project, or?
Exactly. This is a main part of the storing information on the database. These are the main concerns which they have to take over while storing contents on the database. And I think, moreover, they are preferring a cloud Azure thing over for this thing.
Do you have also groups in India which are opposed to this intensive usage of the internet and of new technology? Or is the general awareness in the public that it's good that we develop and this is the only direction we can develop I have this feeling that you have the philosophy of using as much as we can and really deploying it in nearly every aspect of our society where we can see any usage or any benefit out of it.
Yeah, exactly, because as I told you earlier, that India is an optimistic country. They see optimism in every kind of work. Even in security breach, they see a kind of optimism. So that's a positive thing in a kind of them. But there are guys around here who don't believe that much internet usage could be a good thing for them. There are guys. There are guys who run some political parties over here who try to avoid as much as possible to use the internet and stuff. But there are other 90 to 95% of guys are there who still believes that it's a boon for them.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing this for development. You're doing this to to just...
Yeah, exactly. Because we all the guys over here, over in India, do that for accomplishing some stuff. They do their projects. They do whatever they... See, they take information. They do each and every kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which would make them in a better place.
And is there a discussion in the media about such issues? Is there, if you're not in close to the government and if you're not in IT industry, is there often a section in the newspaper about such issues, about these systems being deployed? And I mean, I guess the electronic voting definitely was, but also this biometrical database. How is it discussed in the public, in the media?
Yeah, in media it's totally open. It's in media it's totally promoted over all these things. All these things are promoted by media.
Also in an optimistic way or
Definitely in an optimistic way. But when security evangelists speak against them, that's to also deployed over there. That's to also is told over to the public guys so that they can understand these security concerns which all these measures have and all the measures they have to take to accomplish this thing. We do provide to media all this stuff and they do publish it regularly without any kind of intervention from government or stuff.
Mm-hmm. Which regulation concerning disclosure do you have in India? Is everything full disclosure or responsible disclosure?
See, only the activities which are performed by NTRO or RAW, all those stuffs are disclosed over in India. Rest everything is published under open content.
And you earlier said that the voting machines are Windows embedded version. And how is the general usage of open source in India?
They have open source is a totally big thing over in India, actually. But for some machines, they do testify all these machines because they can use... early electronic voting machines use Linux. They use Linux actually, but after having these problems over these Linux systems, they introduced the electronic voting machine with a Windows embedded concept. They introduced that, but again, after 6 months, it would go back to open source thing. It's a thing like that.
Mm-hmm. But you have this rudimentary Windows base you just trust, or I mean, I know this Windows is deployed in nearly any ATM you have, at least in my country, but. Is this a good choice from your opinion?
From my opinion, I would just say yes, because after having a rigorous testing from various security evangelists and hackers around the country, it's been deployed. So now you can't argue or you can't just, if you have to argue, you have to justify yourself finding a fault out of that. That's this whole thing on how you can justify yourself.
So if you, there's no... ideological question about that. It's just when you find a threat, when you find a security hole, then this is an argument, this has to be fixed, but it's not a general discussion.
Yeah.
Okay. Good, Abhirachi, then I think we are 5 minutes over time. And Abhirachi, I want to thank you for this interview and for this brief insight into the Indian developments. Is there anything you would like to add which I have forgotten to ask?
No, I think I have covered mainly every topic which includes hackers and also the security space of India, as well as from the government perspective, as well as from the normal guy's perspective.
Okay. Yeah. It was a very interesting discussion. You noticed probably that I often was a bit shocked by what you told me, because this is really very different to the perspective we have here in my country, or at least all the perspectives I've heard before. When it comes to hackers, you have a kind of it is an optimistic and neophile ideology, but there's also awareness for the risks and an awareness of the big problems which could come with an infrastructure which you once have deployed. It's very hard to get rid of it afterwards, and you never have a completely secure system, and it's always a constant balance between sides, between attackers and those who are trying to keep it secure. And in the country I'm coming from, it's the The answer to this question is sometimes then it's better not to implement the infrastructure.
Okay, but actually see, as I told you earlier, none of the Indian hackers would go against the Indian government. None of them would like to harm our own people over here.
But even what's with for China? The benefit, what's with Pakistan? There are other countries which do definitely have this intention. If not just fun and profit, would motivate people to go against such critical infrastructure.
Exactly, because see, the digital world, as I told you, is a resurgence of democratic organizations. And moreover, the thing has been changing over here, except for all those countries who are trying to attack different nations to get information. Even the cyber war has been initiated by Stuxnet, as I told you earlier. Mm-hmm. So it's all a kind of thing where whole nations have to deploy their own cyber army. It's time for that. It's time for getting aroused from all this stuff, because moreover, we have been notified that sometimes it's been said that Stuxnet had been organized from Israel or Stuxnet have been organized from China. But the actual thing, it's a war against nations without having any arms.
Yeah, but at the end, it's also individuals acting. And it's maybe commercial or ideological interests which also motivates people. It's not all in these national clusters. It's not all homogenic India,
yeah, exactly.
Homogenic China or Pakistan. We also have individual actors everywhere, and they have different commitments. So you may have a general situation where people are more in favor of the state, but there are always situations where you do things which are against your general ideology, you know?
Exactly. And see, over here also, people do exploit things. As I told you earlier, they do exploit things. They do same stuff as it's done outside. But the only thing is that they are doing it for the benefitment of the country, not for their own benefit. That's the main concept of here.
It's relative. I mean, for example, do you get paid when you find a hole in a government system?
Yeah, we do get paid, and we do get different kind of recognizations, and we do get some kinds of openings from government also. That's the best initiative that they can do for us, and that's the thing that they do for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good, then I thank you for this interview, and maybe we can open up a comment section and keep this discussion going on. And
exactly.
Yeah. Good, then I wish you good luck, and I wish you a lot of security, and hopefully one day the cyber war will end in your country.
Yeah, thank you for your time, Thomas, and I do believe that it would end.
Okay.